I'm very concerned if we don't pass this bill today that this will be an initiative.
If they don't listen to the will of the people will speak.
We can be reasonable, we can communicate, we can be respectful, we can be civil, we can find common ground.
And if our partners buckle under this political pressure, if the hard choices just become too hard, then we'll just keep moving forward.
Mr. Speaker, in conclusion, the $10 founding father without a father who got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter, by 14, they place him in charge of a trading charter.
Welcome to 45 Days, a KUER news podcast where we break down week by week the bills, lawmakers, and the events of the 2017 Utah legislative session. I'm Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, and I'm in studio with reporters Judy Fays, Eric Newman, and Julia Ritchie. Hey.
How's it going?
Thanks.
Hi, Terry.
Wow. Week two of the session, a movement on lots of important issues, but I want to go back about a week ago and talk about something that slipped through the cracks on our podcast last week. It's some really important decisions in regard to the future of medical marijuana in Utah. And I just want to give a little background here. This has been an issue that has dominated the last two sessions, mostly because of the work of Mark Mattson, who at the time was a Republican senator from Eagle Mountain, a devout Latter-day Saint as well. Mattson has a really interesting story about why he started bringing medical marijuana to the fray in Utah. He was experiencing chronic back pain a few years ago and didn't want to use opioid drugs to deal with that back pain. And so on the advice of a couple of friends, he went to Colorado and experimented with medicinal marijuana and had kind of an epiphany about what it did for chronic pain and what it did for him. He came back to the Utah legislature and started telling his story to the press, to members of the Utah Senate, to members of the Utah House, and launched basically a two-year crusade of legislation to try to get a medical marijuana framework in the state of Utah. And that dominated the session last year. His bill, SB 73, was debated and tweaked and worked with all the way up until the final, almost final hours of the session last year. Mark Mattson retired. He is not a senator from Eagle Mountain anymore, but the crusade for medical marijuana continues. And his House co-sponsor on these bills was Representative Gage Froer. He also had some support from Republican Senator Brian Shiozawa, who is an emergency physician in Murray, Utah. But Eric, you were at the press conference last Friday where Gage Froer, Senator Shiozawa, Representative Brad Dahl were talking about the future of medical marijuana in Utah, and some decisions were made. What happened?
Yeah, so those four lawmakers were kind of describing their approach to how to deal with medical marijuana this year. And it really seemed like they're trying to recalibrate their approach, whereas in the past they've tried to actually come up with policies to promote medical marijuana. This year, they're sort of taking a step back and saying, well, we don't really know what the Trump administration's perspective on this is going to be, so we're hesitant to put forth a medical plan for the state. They used a lot of words like lay the groundwork, create framework, kind of talk about the functional ways that medical marijuana would be studied or actually get to patients if it were possible to pass a medical bill down the line. So, for example, Brian Shiozawa's bill will do something like reclassify marijuana from a Schedule 1 drug to a Schedule 2 drug. Schedule 1 is things like heroin, LSD, methamphetamine. Schedule 2 drug is more like opioids like Vicodin or fentanyl or things that we've seen used in medical settings. So this would really allow researchers to study marijuana because there's just not really enough research out there to study the medical effects of marijuana because it is considered a Schedule 1 drug. Brian Shiozawa spoke to that at the press conference that I was at.
We have no legal drug, and we haven't taken the steps nationally to change that. And so if we take it by this step, at least we can find out if it works. And then, as a state, we can move forth responsibly.
So, yeah, they're really trying to sort of take a step back and create more research that will influence their choice to put forward a medical use policy for medical marijuana in the future.
Right. I have a question.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm kind of wondering is, what are the politics of this? Is this death by commission, Or is it a way to put off a very difficult political question to an election year, which would essentially divide the legislature even further, I think, between very conservatives versus people maybe who are a little less conservative?
I think those are all really important questions. And when Senator Mattson and Gage Frewer were running their bills in the last session, Senator Mattson had committee rooms filled with individuals who are chronically ill with different forms of cancer or glaucoma or muscular disorders that where those individuals using marijuana really brought them some kind of physical and mental and emotional peace. So the advocates and the individuals that feel like on a daily basis they need marijuana, or the individuals who want marijuana as an option to deal with chronic pain instead of opioids or other drugs that could be more addictive or addictive completely, for them, this is not good news. But Julia, you came to us from Nevada, where we have where Nevada actually approved not just medical marijuana, but they recently approved marijuana for recreational use. But you've got a little bit of background on what's happened on the medical side there. How do things work in Nevada?
Yeah, we could definitely see Utah maybe following in the footsteps of Nevada, maybe not as quickly. But in Nevada, in 2013, the state authorized the medical marijuana dispensaries. It took an additional 2 to 3 years, though, before they came up with the framework and those regulations that could actually let the operators open their medical marijuana dispensaries. So when I was there, I actually covered the opening of the state's very first medical marijuana dispensary. It was in Sparks, just outside of Reno. And after that, it was a floodgate. It just took those 2 years to hammer out all those things, get those state regulators in place, and figure out how they were going to tax it. Then last year, the ballot initiative came up. It was question two in Nevada, and voters overwhelmingly approved it. But they say it could take another 2 years to get recreational dispensaries up and running. And we'd likely see it in Las Vegas before we see it in a place like Wendover, where Utahns obviously could drive to and get it themselves. So, yeah, I think it takes a while for those regulations to get up and running.
Right. And it seems like the different lawmakers in this press briefing were talking about how they want to just do something practical this year because they don't necessarily feel confident that they could pass a full medical use bill. Gage Frewer kind of gave a good description about that, about how these might not be the best options that marijuana advocates are looking for, but it's sort of a good compromise that they can act on this year.
I think we have to think about the national scene, too, because we have an attorney general coming in, Jeff Sessions, who has been more hostile to medical marijuana, to marijuana in general, and declassifying it. So I think you're going to see some states pull back from maybe going forward with legalizing it just because of what's happening in the Trump administration.
And if I understand it correctly, you're pointing out that medical marijuana in any form, medical, recreational, is illegal under federal law. It still is,
right?
No matter what.
Yes.
And so, when the states are going down one track, that doesn't address the federal issue and whether the federal government would come in and stop it.
Still, plenty of opponents out there.
We'll keep our eye on the medical marijuana bills that are surfacing in the Utah legislature, and I'm sure we'll address them again in 45 days at some point. Let's move on to another major issue in the legislature this week. These were two non-binding resolutions that dealt with the establishment or altering of national monuments. Of course, the Bears Ears National Monument was declared in southern Utah days before President Obama left office. And another resolution dealt with the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument, which was established by President Clinton. These are non-binding resolutions. These are essentially political statements or asks of legislators to the federal government. And what these resolutions are doing is one is asking for President Trump to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument, and the other is calling for President Trump to alter or shrink the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument. Judy Faze, you've been covering this story for months, and you were in the legislature this week when these resolutions were being debated. You talked to folks inside and outside the chamber. What's happening? What do these mean?
Well, I guess a couple of things. One is that many of the legislators who were speaking in support of the resolutions were saying that they were requested by the incoming Trump administration, or now the new Trump administration. But they are both non-binding resolutions. Basically, they're bitter complaints about the monuments. The the monument, the Bears Ears Monument, the request is directly for President Trump to rescind the monument. And I don't know, maybe we want to hear some tape on that.
This is Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes.
You see, Utah has somehow, because of it being a public land state, it's turned into this ATM for exiting Democrat administrations who want to pay the political paybacks to special interest groups who absolutely and in their own minds care that as much land can be encumbered as humanly possible. They would like a little bit of credit sent their way. Well, Utah has become the source of that, and it comes at a price.
Well, there are two things about that I think are that cut that are very telling. Is one, that this for many people is a political issue. It's purely a political issue, because if you look at the Congressman Rob Bishop's Public Lands Initiative, the land that is in conservation areas in the PLI is almost identical to the land that's in the Bears Ears National Monument. So he's saying that this is a payback, but this is actually something that Utah had already been working on. And in fact, under the Obama administration, we know from leaked documents from years ago that this was an area that's been under consideration throughout the Obama administration. And in fact, it had been under consideration for decades. So it was kind of interesting to me to hear that. I guess one of the big questions is, well, what could the Trump administration do about it? And I think, like so many other things in the Trump administration, it's a wild card. I don't think anyone really knows for sure. The record is legally that monuments have been challenged, including the Grand Staircase, and they have held up. That the president has a right to declare a monument. The president also has a right to scale back a monument. And I've heard numbers that are pretty dramatic, that as much as 2/3 of the monument could be scaled back under President Trump. To me, it seems like this is going to be an issue that's going to be around for quite a while.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is this a test of Utah's political capital? Because, you know, so far we've seen names floated that Trump might pick for the administration from Utah, Mitt Romney obviously being passed over for Secretary of State. But so far, we haven't seen him really reach deep into the Utah political sphere and do anything. Do you think that this is going to be a real test to see if Orrin Hatch or someone can get that favor done?
You know, I think it's certainly a possibility, because if one of the interesting things to me about this, the two pieces of legislation we're talking about, is that in the case of the Bears Ears Monument Bill, it's being carried by the Speaker of the House. And in the Senate, the floor manager will be the President of the Senate, Wayne Niederhauser. I mean, I don't know how often anyone else here has seen a Speaker get off the podium and manage a bill, but it's very rare.
It's unusual.
Very rare. So they're carrying some, you know, heavy water for the administration, or I'm sorry, for the congressional delegation, which made this request.
Could this this option of repealing relate to the Antiquities Act in a bigger way? I know there was like some talk about how it could put that whole act in jeopardy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this will be an interesting challenge, because I think the lawyers who are involved in it were confident about it. I know of three lawyers who were involved in the negotiations and in moving this forward, and I understand that two of them were very confident that the Antiquities Act would hold up, but a third one was a little more reticent. These are all people who really understand it. And so I think, again, this is the wild card. Will the Trump administration succeed where other administrations have not? The Grand Staircase bill, I think, is even more interesting in a way, or the resolution. It's being carried by Representative Mike Noel, who apparently Senator Orrin Hatch has asked the Trump administration to make him the BLM director. He has a history at the BLM, and not all of it is very good. He did leave after several decades working there, and has been a big critic of the agency since then. So I don't know, maybe that's perfect Trump to include someone like that.
The other part of this issue is tribal sovereignty, right? And you talk to a lot of individuals. I want to listen to Representative Angela Romero. This is something that she said in the floor debate on these resolutions on tribal sovereignty.
Tribal governments have the constitutional right under the Commerce Clause to exercise their form of governance and determine for themselves their future. It would be hypocritical of us in this legislative body to impose this resolution, which is clearly a symbolic attack on tribal sovereignty, to get back at the federal government. In essence, we are doing the same thing to the tribes as some of us perceive the federal government doing to us here in Utah. For many tribal citizens, this land is sacred and worthy of protection.
Again, I think that's another really interesting piece of tape. Angela Romero is one of the few Native American state legislators in the country, one of a handful. And she, again, is a tribal member, not of any of the Utah tribes. I think this is really sort of the crux of the issue with Bears Ears for in sort of a broader sense, and that is that the Bears Ears National Monument gives tribes literally a seat at the table for managing the land, and they feel like they deserve this. I think a lot of Utah Native Americans feel like the state stole its name, stole their name, and then disregards them and disregards their concerns and their interests. So I think we have one more cut that I think really goes to that, Moroni Benali.
What it does is it symbolically signals to tribes that tribal sovereignty doesn't matter. It signals that tribal interests don't matter. It signals that tribal rights to protect what they believe is sacred doesn't matter. And that really is at the core of this symbolic gesture, really, of asking the current administration to rescind the Bears Ears. And so that's what really is at stake here, is the symbolic value of saying that tribes really don't matter and that the state of Utah knows better than the tribes what the tribes need.
And this is Moroni Benali, who's the leader of the League of Native American Voters in Utah. And you spoke with him outside of the chamber while this debate was going on.
Correct. One of the things that was not in that clip was Moroni later said to me, you know, Bears Ears is not over. No matter what happens this week with the vote on the Bears Ears resolution, it is not over. And to that point, there are actually hearings going on this week in the Senate, which will be the first sort of public look at this and discussion of this of these resolutions. And then on Friday, my understanding is the Senate is expected to actually vote on both of the resolutions. There's not apparently a question that it won't pass. On the Grand Staircase Ascalani National Monument, the resolution asks for Congress to change the monument. And that actually is different legal ground than having the president do it. And I'm not really sure, you know, what sort of chances there are that that would go forward. But maybe with a new conservative Supreme Court justice from the West, they would find a greater affinity for paring back some of these national monuments.
Let's get an update now on a bill we talked about last week, which has made some forward progress. This is HB 11. And this bill, if passed, would drop the partisan equality requirements on some state boards and commissions. It passed the House this week by a vote of 51-21, and it now moves to the Senate. Eric, you were there to witness the floor debate this week. Julia, you covered this bill in committee last week. Eric, let's start with you in the list. What happened on the floor this week?
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating. It's Norm Thurston is really the champion of this bill, and he gave some description about what this bill would allow legislators to do and the community to do is essentially take out this unnecessary political balance requirement from boards and commissions throughout the state, a series of boards and commissions, I should say. It started with just 29 boards and commissions that they had chosen. And allow them to prioritize other requirements. Like he mentioned things like the geography of the members of those boards that are more relevant to necessarily having a certain number of Democrats and a certain number of Republicans. Or he said some other things like maybe a mix of genders or a mix of different minorities or people of different races on these boards and commissions. And it got quite a bit of debate on the floor. Pretty much Republican representatives were in support of it. Several Democrats were pretty vocally against it. Maybe we should just take a listen to Thurston's cut, just describing why this is important.
So here's Representative Norm Thurston on the House floor this week talking about HB 11.
Really, what we want are people, regardless of politics, with very distinct professional knowledge and background. The focus on party affiliation is problematic and the practical impediment to getting our job done.
And so it's kind of interesting because it seemed like Democrats saw it as this erosion of control of their party on this very grassroots local level. Some of these are pretty obscure boards that probably don't interact with a lot of people on a daily basis. Others are big ones like air quality boards, water quality boards. So it's a real mix of ways that this change could affect people's lives.
I think this really is incredibly threatening to Democrats. Anything that threatens any kind of partisan requirement, because they are such a super minority in the Utah legislature and really in the state of Utah, the stakes are really high with them. Joel Briscoe, who's a representative Democrat from Salt Lake County here, had some interesting things to say on the floor. And I just want to set up this piece of tape. He, in what he's about to say, compares what's happening with this bill on the partisan requirement on state boards and commissions with what happened with the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. And I know that sounds a little odd. Bear with me. Let's listen to this piece of tape and then we'll talk about it.
And we have stronger boards, in my opinion, on the state. If we do more than just say, I'm not looking at your political affiliation, I'm going out and I am purposely looking to get different points of view. I'm purposely looking to find people who are technically qualified but can bring to the table something that is different than everyone else around here. My brother shows a video of Morton Thiokol making the decision to go ahead with the Challenger launch. And there was one man aside Morton Thiokol who said, no, we should not launch today. They launched, every astronaut on board was killed on the space shuttle. One man aside, Morton Thiokol, said, it is not technically safe. He was overruled. And my brother shows this video to talk about the dangers of groupthink, the dangers of everyone getting together and having the same opinion.
Groupthink, that's what Joel Briscoe is talking about here. He's comparing a Morton Thiokol engineer, by the way, his name was Bob Ebling. He lived in northern Utah. Him being overruled by another group of people. And I think, if anything, as hyperbolic as this may sound, if anything, this shows us in lots of ways what Democrats think of what's happening with this bill. The question is, after the bill has now passed out of the House, do they have any path to fight this at all as a superminority?
We should say the Republicans did throw them a bone this week by reducing that number from 29 to 24. So they did take off things that were considered more political, like the water control board, is it, or the drinking water, and the alcoholic beverage and control was taken off. But in essence, we're still seeing an erosion of political, you know, requirements in the state. And I think people are thinking in a larger context. Right now, on the national level, we have all three levels of government are controlled by one party. In my home state of North Carolina, we've seen things like this too, where both houses have a supermajority of Republicans. And before Democratic Governor Roy Cooper came in, they passed some sweeping bills to take away some of his authority. So I don't think we can look at this situation in just the bubble of, hey, it's just an administrative burden. I think we have to look at what's going on in state houses around the country.
But Judy, you and I were talking about this. The language of the bill is interesting because the language of the bill really says that not one political party should dominate, yet there is one political party that does dominate.
Well, I think that the idea of balance is making sure that it isn't one political party dominating the whole thing. And in fact, I think it's really interesting if you look at the wording of the bill, it actually says that political considerations are not allowed to be considered. They're not allowed, permitted to be part of the discussion, which is a little bit different and in some respects a little bit stronger, I think, because if political diversity is one of the things you do want as a decision maker to get perspective, then you're not even supposed to raise the question. For years, the Utah Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission did not have any drinkers on it. And It just reminds me of that old Saturday Night Live skit with a bunch of guys drinking beer, sitting around talking about women's problems. It was a show about women's problems and solving them, but a bunch of guys sitting there solving them. So I think that the discussion about groupthink is really interesting, and it'll be interesting to see if that resonates with anyone.
Representative Patrice Arrant has said, "I don't think it's because you couldn't find enough Democrats to serve on these boards that you're having difficulty filling them. I think it's because they have their low pay to no pay, and they require tons of work on really controversial issues." And as I mentioned last week, another representative said, "Hey, we have a binder full of Democrats we can give you if you're having problems filling these boards."
But it's not just Democrats, though. There's a very strong independent streak in Utah. There are a lot of unaffiliated voters. So
Libertarians, other affiliations,
right,
too. And we should mention that Representative Thurston has said, you know, why not consider things like geographical diversity, gender diversity, and even ethnic diversity when looking at these boards. But for some reason, this is the thing that they're going after.
Well, actually, in most of the board descriptions, there are very specific places where the board members have to come from. And that in and of itself is an interesting discussion. But I guess one of the things that all of these subjects really make me think about is sort of the broader political divide in our community and how, in a way, whether you're talking about bear's ears or you're talking about medical marijuana or the boards, how are we going to be able to have conversations about things of mutual interest? Is it always just going to be the person who's, you know, king of the hill who gets to decide? And what's lost in our community and in our political discourse? At any rate, I mean, on the bear's ears question, they talk about local influence in these decisions. And yet, for the Native Americans, that's a very valid point. I think Angela Romero made that point, too. But they really represent, you know, an almost equally divided community with different ideas about how things should go.
Let's end the discussion there. Plenty more to talk about next week. Thanks, you guys. Eric Newman, Judy Fays, and Julia Ritchie. Thanks for being in studio today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
45 Days is a KUER News podcast. JT Nebaker composed our music. Today's episode was produced by myself and Tim Slover. I'm Terry Gilday.